I'm John Kroll. Friday is IUPUI's annual Research Day. Today on No Limits, we will talk about what the Research Day is, how it got started, and what it involves. We'll discuss the day's activities and how members of the public might be able to plug into them. My guests are the event's keynote speaker, National Public Radio science correspondent John Hamilton, and IUPUI's interim vice chancellor Simon Atkinson. Please join the conversation. Call us at 866-476-3881, email nolimits at WFYI.org, Facebook is No Limits WFYI, Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. Today on No Limits, we're going to be talking about IUPUI's upcoming annual Research Day, which is this Friday, April 8th. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits at WFYI.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Simon Atkinson, who is the interim vice chancellor for research at IUPUI, and we should be joined shortly by John Hamilton, who is NPR's science correspondent. He's currently focusing on neuroscience. He'll also be the keynote speaker for the event on Friday. And I should say before I get started in the program, I'd like to thank Jill Dittmeyer for filling in so ably last week while I was away. Well, Simon, why don't you tell me a little bit about the genesis of Research Day, how it got started?
Well, first of all, John, thanks very much for having me on the show today. So Research Day was started in 2009, actually, and our first keynote speaker was Leon Lederman, who is a Nobel laureate. The genesis of the idea for Research Day was really to pull the campus together, pull all the researchers who are sometimes a little bit siloed in their departments and schools together, so that basically we could find out what different investigators across campus are actually doing. And then further to showcase to the Indianapolis community in particular some of the exciting things that are going on at IUPUI.
And how many, when you say how many researchers, how many of your scientists are involved in Research Day?
So we typically have about 500 attendees at Research Day. This year we have over 200 posters that will be presented, many by graduate students and undergraduate students along with their mentors. We'll have a couple of speakers at Research Day who are award winners on campus. So a good number of our scientists from all across the campus, from the medical school, from the other professional schools, and from science and liberal arts. So very diverse range of research topics and different types of scholarship.
Does life pretty much shut down on campus on the 8th, or are classes and all other things going on while all of this activity is taking place?
There are classes still going on, so our students don't get a break for Research Day or our faculty. But many of the people on campus will be focused on Research Day. We also have Cornell West speaking on campus in the afternoon on Friday, so that will certainly be a diversion for a lot of folks.
And is it possible for members of the public to come and
absolutely
attend?
Yes.
How do they go about that?
The best way to do that is to go to our website, which is research.iupui.edu, and then there's a link right there to Research Day. We do ask people to register in advance if you can, and that can be done on the website. But it's perfectly fine for folks to turn up and just join us for the presentations and the posters.
And of course, your keynote speaker is John Hamilton from NPR this year. John, are you with us now?
I am.
Oh, it's good to have you on board. What could you give us a little bit of a taste of what you're going to be talking about on Friday.
Yeah, I'm going to talk about the sort of changing media landscape and how I and how NPR is trying to fit into it. It's a very different world now with so much existing on the internet. And it's not just typing, of course, on the internet. Now there's a lot of audio on the internet. And so as a place that is known for doing audio, we're having to adapt to this different world. And I'm also going to talk a little bit about why it is that certain publications, certain scientific discoveries get covered by the media and why some don't, because I think that's something that puzzles a lot of scientists.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about IUPUI's upcoming annual research day, which is this Friday, April 8th. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. You can tumble upon us on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what Gary has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Gary, welcome to the program.
Hello?
Hello, yes, Gary, you're on the air.
Oh, okay. Well, I had a question which is actually related to what the last speaker said about what gets media attention and what doesn't. I understand that science is and medicine, particularly at IUPUI, are major sources of research and research funding and get a lot of attention. But IUPUI for 6 years now has also had a major Shakespeare research project, which is very well known nationally and internationally among researchers in Shakespeare, which is a global thing, especially this year with the anniversary. But I suspect that not many people in Indiana know about this aspect of IUPUI, which people tend to think of as a science and medicine campus. And so why is it that the humanities don't get as much attention? This project is about to be launched later this year, the first phase of it anyway, with a major new edition of Shakespeare. Professor Terry Boris in the English department is the head of the project, and they're going to be represented actually at Research Day on Friday.
Well, thank you very much for the call and the information and the question. I'm going to throw that one to Simon, but among other things, Gary, I think you've given us an idea for a future No Limits, so thank you very much for the call.
I'm sure they'd be delighted.
Certainly.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I think this is something that we're very proud of at IPUI. Terry Boris is an internationally recognized Shakespeare scholar. She's the editor now of the Oxford Shakespeare edition. So this is really international recognition for her work. As to why humanities research doesn't get so much attention, I think that's a good question. I think research in medicine or in engineering is sometimes very easy for people to conceive of applications to their daily lives or impact on their family. And research in areas in arts and humanities, sometimes it's more difficult for people to make those connections to everyday life, even though there are many of us who love to see Shakespeare before performed and to read his works. I think that idea of why some things don't get attention really, really goes way beyond the arts and humanities. There are many areas of the scholarship and research of IPUI faculty and faculty at other universities that doesn't get that kind of recognition. And I think it's important for us to find a way to make connections for the general public with what we're doing.
John, let me ask this. I know from my days as a newspaper reporter, and admittedly this has been a few years ago, that even science coverage could be difficult to get into traditional media. I mean, one of the reasons, for example, university up the road, Purdue, did the Rube Goldberg thing, was to try to attract some attention to the work that they were doing there, and even though it had next to no practical application. Is it because the subjects are more difficult or intimidating? What is the challenge there of getting people to pay attention to these issues?
I think the public is really interested in science, and I'm fortunate to work at a place where our science coverage is one of the things that NPR listeners say that they really tune in for. So, you know, I'm perhaps in a privileged position, but I think the challenge is it's one thing to have scientists who do amazing things, who do extraordinary research. It's another thing to find scientists who are good at telling their own story, explaining to people not only in a jargon-free way what they've done, but then stepping back a little bit and helping people get some perspective on it. I think the scientists who are able to do that actually do very well when it comes to reaching, getting media attention.
So what stories are the ones that people respond to the most that you have done?
Well, there are certain stories I do. I cover a lot of brain science. And so if I were to put one word in a headline that is guaranteed to get a lot of coverage, it would be autism. It's probably in part because we have many, many listeners who have children. They're concerned about this subject. It's also something that really the public has become very aware of as every year the CDC has issued the number of or the rates of autism among 8-year-olds, and that number keeps climbing up, and every year it gets a lot of attention. So I think people are focused on it. I think it also gets to a lot of things to do with human behavior, and I think that's another thing that people find very interesting, what makes us who we are, how we behave, things like that.
Simon, in terms of the events on Friday, what do you anticipate will be the things that really pull people in, that generate the most interest?
Well, I obviously
other than the keynote speaker,
I think so. We'll kick off with announcing what we call the IEPY Research Trailblazer Awards. So this is an award that's given to IEPY faculty who are relatively early in their career. They've just got through the tenure process in the last couple of years. And what we're really looking for is the research superstars of the future, people who are on that trajectory to build an international reputation in their field. So we'll have those awardees will be announced, and we've asked them to give a 5-minute potted version of their whole research agenda. So hopefully that will be done in a way that's accessible to our audience, and the people who will be announced on Friday are really doing tremendously exciting research that I think people will appreciate.
And I'm presuming the announcement is embargoed until Friday.
That's correct, yeah.
Can you talk to us about some past winners since you've been doing this and the sort of work that has been on it?
Yeah, so one of our past winners I could talk about is Jason Kelly, who now heads our Arts and Humanities Institute. So this is recognition for work in the arts and humanities. Jason's work is on he's a British historian, and he's focused on the impact of the Industrial Revolution on the health and environment of rivers in the UK. And he's expanded this into a more general interest into the impact of industrialization on the environment, both in the era of the Industrial Revolution and in the 20th and 21st century.
And what are the criteria for winning these awards?
The criteria are we ask the faculty to tell us what they've been doing. We ask external experts in their field to evaluate whether these are really the rising stars. So we're really trying to make a prediction of who's going to be the scholar in a particular area of research 10 years from now.
And what does the recipient receive for all of these efforts?
Well, apart from a crown of laurels, they receive some honorarium from the campus and a lot of recognition from their school and department.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about IUPUI's upcoming annual research day, which is this Friday, April 8th, and it's an all-day event. We are talking right now with Dr. Simon Atkinson, who is IUPUI's interim vice chancellor for research. And joining us from Washington is John Hamilton, who is NPR's science correspondent and currently focusing on neuroscience. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about IUPUI's upcoming annual research day this Friday, April 8th. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. My guests are John Hamilton, who is NPR's science correspondent and currently focusing on neuroscience. He's going to be the keynote speaker for the event, and Dr. Simon Atkinson, who is IUPUI's interim vice chancellor for research. Well, John, I wanted to talk a little bit about the process of communicating what can be fairly complicated and complex questions for what even in our world remains. I know I can say this as a fellow NPR host of sorts. We have a very, very smart audience, but it's still a mass audience. How do you break down and try to make the reporting accessible for the people who are listening?
Well, there are a number of things we do. I mean, as a reporter who covers science, you do certainly cultivate a Rolodex full of people who are good explainers, and that helps a lot. But I think in recent years, we've really begun to focus more on how to draw people into science stories. And we do, you know, the sort of buzzword of media these days is storytelling. Everybody wants to tell you a story. And I think in science, that can be very powerful. I find myself doing many more stories, especially where the matter is something really arcane, where I try to include a personal story. So, for instance, not so long ago, I did a story which was explaining research about the cerebellum, what has been learned about this part of the brain that was assumed to be pretty simple, involved in balance and things like that, and turned out to be involved in a lot more things. But I told the story with letting you meet somebody who actually does not have a cerebellum and him talking about what that experience is like. And I think it was a way to make the whole subject a lot more accessible. Then when people heard some of the scientific explanations, I think they felt like there was a little bit more understanding, a little more context to what they were getting.
So the key is trying to find sort of the human entry point.
That is often the key. It is not the only key. I think that ideas can sustain a story, but certainly people, especially on the radio, which is a pretty intimate medium, mm-hmm. I think hearing human voices, human stories, is often the most powerful way to get people's attention.
We are talking about IUPUI's upcoming annual research day on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Trevor, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
Well, I just wanted to call. This is a very interesting conversation, and I appreciate it very much. Your guest was mentioning the personal stories and so forth, and we are not part of the research day. I am actually a faculty at IUPUI, and I'm a director of civic engagement for communication studies. I just wanted to let your guest know about this as well. If there is a... we're sponsoring four events coming up called the Hijabi Dialogues, which is trying to craft dialogue between people of different faiths, particularly Muslim women, Hijabi women, speaking with non-Muslim women. And we have four performances coming up at the Fringe Theater at IUPUI. IUPUI on the 20th. On the 23rd at the Fringe Theater, a matinee performance, also working with the Invoke Media in Broad Ripple on the 29th, which is Friday, and then at the Big Car Gallery, their new two art space in on May 7th. And I don't know, just it speaks to the we'd love to have any collaboration in terms of marketing this. If anyone who's listening might want to be a part of this, we still have room for a few more women of different places in terms of identity, culture, faith, just trying to craft a dialogue between different women in the Indianapolis community. And I just want to thank you for this opportunity to speak about that.
Certainly. Thanks for the call, Trevor.
You bet. Thank you.
Sure thing. Is it difficult sort of figuring out which parts? IUPUI is a large campus with a lot of activity involved. Figuring out which ones you're going to highlight at any given time, Simon.
Oh, I think that's tremendously difficult. I think you know, one of the things that we do like to highlight is connected with what Trevor was just saying, that many of our faculty, many of our investigators and researchers are doing work in the community. So they are doing community-based research. They're doing performances. They're doing exhibits out in the community, and they are very connected with many of the community organizations in the Indianapolis and central Indiana area. And I think there is a lot of mutual support between our investigators and these organizations. So that's certainly one of the aspects of IUPUI that we like to highlight. But as far as the particular disciplines, I think we are open to anybody who comes and wants to participate in Research Day and showcase what they're doing. And there's a lot of enthusiasm for doing that across the campus.
What is the goal for Research Day? I mean, what do you hope it will accomplish? How do you say, oh, well, that was a successful event?
Oh, I think there are two goals. So one goal is to pull the campus together, to tell each other, for the faculty to tell each other what we're up to. And for me, it's a successful event if somebody at the end of the day says, you know, I saw this poster at Research Day. I talked to this student. I had no idea that this was going on the IUPUI campus, and that's really cool. I think the other goal is to really connect with the Indianapolis community, and we do that by inviting people to attend Research Day, and particularly by inviting high school students to come to Research Day, where they can meet some of the undergraduate and graduate students who are actively involved in research projects. And meet them at their posters, find out what they're doing, and perhaps for some of those students, they'll see a future for themselves in that kind of role, actively engaged in research right from the beginning of their undergraduate careers.
Do your faculty, staff, and students, I mean, is this a big event for them? Is it something that they really anticipate, and how does that, if so, how does that excitement manifest itself?
I think there'll be a lot of work preparing posters going on over the next few days, especially from our students. They've been working all year long on research projects with faculty across the campus, and this is their chance to sit down and think about what they've been doing over the last two semesters, or perhaps longer, and really pull that together into a poster presentation and show off what they've been doing. And in many cases, there'll be significant research achievements by those students represented on those posters that will end up in serious academic publications.
John, you mentioned earlier that you know that any story you do about autism is likely to attract a lot of feedback and a lot of interest. What is the science story, trend, or development that we are not paying attention to right now that we should be, that is important?
Well, I'm a little biased toward the brain since that's what I cover.
Yeah.
But I think there are a couple of things that people may not be aware of having to do with the brain. One of them is people worry about Alzheimer's, and the public rightly has the perception that the progress, the research on a treatment for Alzheimer's has been pretty slow, pretty frustrating. There have been some big setbacks. There were some drugs a number of years ago that were tried, a lot of high hopes, and they did not pan out. So I think a lot of the public has, to a large extent, sort of dropped out thinking, this is going nowhere. But when I look at the research that's being done on Alzheimer's and the understanding of the disease, it has come so far in the past 15 years. Of the understanding, there's a good understanding now of why some of the drugs didn't work. There is a much deeper understanding of the process that goes on. And what's even more interesting is there is now this emerging understanding of how Alzheimer's disease is related to other what you call degenerative brain diseases, things mm-hmm. like Parkinson's. And then, in fact, you're seeing the process in all of those diseases has a lot in common. And so I think when people ask me what I think the next big thing is going to be as far as affecting a disease, I think it may well be Alzheimer's, and I think many people are not aware of that.
And in keeping with your focus on the brain, we've talked about autism and to some degree Alzheimer's. Those are subjects of concern. Do people respond to more sort of hopeful developments? We've done a couple of shows here actually on how by studying the brain and by studying how it receives and processes information that we might be able to develop some new educational models, that the research has gotten us to the point that we've learned a lot of the things that we've been doing aren't necessarily effective. Do those kinds of shows or stories have the same traction as the things that we are worried about? The autism. No one wants autism. No one wants Alzheimer's. I'm sorry.
Right,
to cut
right.
You off.
And certainly it's a truism in journalism that fear sells. When people are afraid of something, they tend to listen to the story.
Leads. Yeah.
Yes. But I think there is a huge interest in at least our listenership of things that have to do with how does the brain work. Where does altruism come from? How do we learn? Why is it that some people's brains take in information or process information this way and some other people process it in a different way? Where does trust come from? They're all of these things that people, I think, really engage with. I'm always surprised how many people write and comment on stories I do that are just the latest stuff on how some aspect, the latest research on how the brain works in some specific way.
We've gotten a Facebook question from a listener named Deanne, and if you'd like to reach out to us on Facebook, you can find us at No Limits WFYI. It says, your guest mentioned autism as one of the main disciplines they would be researching regarding the brain. I'm interested to know if the autism to general population ratio is the same as fewer than or more than here in the USA, I think here in Indiana, as opposed to United States. Do you have breakdowns on that, John?
The numbers in autism are very tricky. It seems to be a disorder, a condition, where the harder you look, the more you find. And so you can, in theory, you can compare numbers from one state to another, but I think most of the scientists believe those comparisons are really not apples to apples. And their assumption is that the rate of autism, the chance that a child will develop autism, is pretty much the same regardless of where you are in the country and regardless of where you are in the world. There was an interesting study several years ago where American researcher led an effort to find all of the children who had autism in South Korea. And it was possible because of the way the healthcare system is set up there and because they got wonderful cooperation from the South Korean government. And what they found was a rate that was even higher than the United States. And they don't think that's because those children are more likely to have it. They think it's because they have a system where they were able to do a better job finding each and every child who met the criteria for autism.
Is that, I know just enough about autism to be dangerous, and I probably ought to ask for a definition here because I understand. as I understand it, at least some of the research and the thinking is that we should be thinking of autism more as a spectrum than a condition. Is that true?
That is absolutely correct. And we now refer to autism spectrum disorders or disorder or disorders. And it is a spectrum, so you have symptoms that range from barely perceptible to very, very severe. And it is a range of things. It is a collection of behaviors that when you have enough of them, you may meet the criterion for a diagnosis. But it has changed over the years, and there is no it's not a black and white thing.
So is some of it because we have a now presumably more sophisticated understanding of what autism is? Is that one of the driving forces behind why there are larger numbers now?
Yeah, I mean, there is, of course, a debate about whether more children are developing autism or autism spectrum disorder as they grow up. And there is no good answer to that yet. There have been a lot of, going back to people thinking that vaccines were causing it and environmental pollutants, there have been a lot of ideas floated out there, none of which seems to have really, really stuck. But the one thing that everybody agrees on is that as people become more aware of the autism spectrum disorders, they are more likely to detect kids who should be evaluated. And the other thing that's happened is as there are more services available to children who meet the diagnostic criteria, there is more reason for people to make sure they detect those kids and get them the services. So it's a range of factors. But I think if you were to look at one thing that has really changed is, you know, autism has only really been commonly known in the last 40, 50 years, right? Mm-hmm. And I think any time you have an entire population who becomes aware of something, you begin to see and find a lot more of it.
Simon, I want to ask the same question I asked somewhat of John, of the story that we're not paying attention to that we should be. What parts of Research Day, what things, presumably there are going to be some things that will draw larger crowds than others. What is an important part of this that doesn't get a lot of attention and should?
Well, I think on our campus, research related to autism and addiction disorders is a prominent part of our research portfolio that goes all the way from the genetics of those disorders to the social sciences surrounding those disorders. So I hope that's an area of research that people will pay attention to when they attend Research Day.
Do they do those areas get a lot of attention at when you've had previous research days?
Well, I think perhaps not so much, but I think with the growing crisis of opioid addiction, particularly in this state, I think yeah, that's an area that is going to get a lot more attention this year and in future as showcases of research here and elsewhere.
Does that go into how you put together the program? Is saying, okay, this is important work. It's not receiving the attention, or to some degree, since the attention also can be manifested in terms of fundraising support, all of that it should get. We need to get it out there in a spotlight more.
I think the way Research Day works is it's more like a marketplace. So it's really for researchers to set up their stalls and showcase what they're doing to the rest of the community, rather than us directing what's presented there.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about IUPUI's upcoming annual Research Day. It's an all-day event this Friday, April 8th. We are talking with the event's keynote speaker, John Hamilton. He is NPR's science correspondent who is focusing primarily these days on neuroscience, and with Dr. Simon Atkinson, who is IUPUI's interim vice chancellor for research. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about IUPUI's upcoming annual research day, which is this Friday, April 8th. My guests are Dr. Simon Atkinson, who is IUPUI's interim vice chancellor for research. And joining us from Washington is NPR science correspondent John Hamilton, who is the event's keynote speaker. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can track us down on Twitter at nolimits, or you can do what Gary has done, regular listener named Gary, who has sent us a message through Facebook at nolimitswfyi. And Gary says, I have a question after being in attendance 1 year. How many successes are coming from the research? Please explain if success is determined by assisting professors to gain funding. Simon, I think we'll throw that one your way.
Yes, that's a very good question. I think sometimes when we try and measure the impact of our research, what we're actually measuring is the input to our research, which is the number of dollars and research funding that we get, which IPUI was about $380 million last year. But what we should really be measuring is the impact of our research, and of course that's much harder to quantify. So we can look at what our faculty publish, and that's very nice for their careers. But what's the real impact on the community? This is something that Indiana University has been thinking about. So the president launched a Grand Challenges initiative last year, which is going to be a major investment of the university's resources to try and make our research as outward-facing as possible, to have real direct impact on problems and issues in the community, which could be related to health, could be related to the environment, could be related to security or some other topic. So I think that it's very important to rethink the ways that we measure research to really weigh the actual impact on society, rather than the things that are much easier to measure, like dollars and numbers of publications and those kind of things.
John, that question of success when it comes to scientific research is a complicated one, isn't it?
It certainly is. I have a colleague who likes to go and look at people who've won Nobel Prizes and then go look to see how much attention the original paper they wrote on that subject got. And usually the answer is almost none. So was that a failure when they did it? Kind of depends how you define success and failure, right?
Well, and I'm thinking also, I obviously have not done the reporting you have, but I spend a fair amount of time with my colleagues in the sciences at the college where I work, and I'm sure they would argue that finding out that something doesn't work is also a product of successful research as well. It's not just achieving the desired effect, it's eliminating the things that do not work. Simon, you're nodding your head.
I think that there's been a lot of discussion in the scientific community about just issue over recent years, the degree to which the scientific literature is maybe biased by not including those negative results, which, as you say, in many cases are just as important, but almost impossible to publish in many of the leading journals in our disciplines. I think there is a lot of interest in perhaps looking at alternative models for how we publish the results of our science, to try and include more of that kind of important information that doesn't get you a paper in Science or Nature, but may have just as much impact on the field if it becomes generally known.
Gotten an email from a listener named Marilyn with in the subject line, brains and a little smiley face. And she says, and I should say, if you want to reach out to us by email, you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org. She says, I am so glad to hear the talk about brains. I have a son with a serious mental illness, and my father died with Alzheimer's. There were many similarities. I think the more we study all the brain disorders, including autism, addictions, the more we will learn and more quickly. Thank you, Marilyn. In the spirit of that, John, I mean, where do you think the next big breakthroughs are going to come in our study of the brain? Because it does seem like we are at one of those major leaps forward in our understanding.
I think we are. If I could just step back for a sec, what you're talking about success and failure. When I mentioned before the great optimism now about finding something to treat Alzheimer's, that really came out of the enormous failure. There was an idea that it was all about controlling beta amyloid, and that all you need to do was have some drugs that go mop this up and the problem is done. And it was discovering that was wrong. It was that failure that really pushed people to have a much deeper understanding of the total process that leads to this problem in the brain. So as far as next breakthroughs, you can go a lot of different directions. I think some of the stuff I'm most interested in has to do with the sort of neurological underpinnings of the complex human behaviors. And, you know, this is with functional magnetic resonance imaging and studies where they're able now with a technique called optogenetics, where you're able to manipulate brain cell populations. We're beginning to understand what it is that leads us to act the way we do. And it's starting simply as these things always do. You know, there are mice where you can tell their brains to make them turn left or turn right. You can make them depressed by turning on certain populations of brain cells. But those are the beginnings of really understanding how our brain makes us behave the way we do and feel the way we do. And if I point to one area where I think there's going to be really interesting stuff in the next 10 or 20 years, that would probably be it.
We've gotten another email from a listener named Bridget who says, could you please ask your neuroscience guests whether there is any research being done on nonverbal learning disorder, which is separate and distinct from autism and Asperger's? NVLD, as children become adults, is much less about academics and much more about dealing with anxiety and depression due to the inability to deal with nonverbal communication, which is critical to a healthy life. I understand that it's due to impairment of the white matter in the right brain and possibly, and I'm hoping I'm pronouncing this word right, splenium. It needs research, and I need to know where to turn. I'll throw that one your way, John.
All right. First of all, let me caution that I was an English major. Your guest from the humanities would appreciate that.
Okay.
But I do not pretend to be a neuroscientist. I'm a reporter who talks to a lot of very smart brain scientists. But I think part of what she's talking about there gets back to this question of the links between so many different things that go wrong in the brain. When you start talking about white matter, you're talking about the connections in between different parts of the brain. And that seems to be related to all kinds of things. Autism, there's a lot of talk about whether there might be too many connections, at least in some areas of the brain, that causes an overload of sorts. In schizophrenia, there's talk about whether some distant parts of the brains are not connected enough. You're talking about really different variations of the same problem that manifest in these very different ways. And I think it's quite likely that as scientists study more of as they get to know more about these diseases, they're beginning to see the commonalities, and they may be able to explain the things like nonverbal learning disorder because of research that's done on some of these other conditions.
We are talking about IUPUI's annual research day on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Laura, welcome to the program.
Hi. My gosh, I can't believe I got through. Hi, guys. How are you?
Hi.
We're doing well. What's on your mind, Laura?
I've been listening. I've been driving today like I always do to get kids and drop kids off. And I was at CTS. I was actually in their MHC program, and I was thinking about, like, this really hard empirical look at behavior and cultural identity and, like, how we parse this out and how we call that research and how that fits up next to what we call, quote-unquote, the softer sciences, you know, like, you know, psychology is a softer science, and I've heard that referred to over and over again, and I'm just curious, like, I just am feeling curious about Research Day and what qualifies for it, and how do we decide what's worthy of research and what is research? You know, these big open questions, which to me just equal research. So I was just thinking about it and listening to you guys and totally enjoying the conversation and a little bit wondering about, like, where are we going to set our trajectory? You know, are we going to take arts out of the schools? Are we going to take these little soft bits of the not knowing away from the knowing?
Mm-hmm. Well, let me see if I can get some answers for you, Laura. I'm going to throw this one first to Simon, but thank you very much for the call.
Well, that's a very big picture question. As far as the practicalities of what's included in research, it's everything we do on the campus. So all the research and scholarship and some of the creative activity of the faculty in the Heron School of Art, for example. But Laura mentioned the softer sciences. I think that's, you know, perhaps not the best term. I think, you know, sometimes the social sciences that Laura was referring to are maybe the harder sciences, because they involve measuring things that are very difficult to measure. Just as hard as measuring the energy of particles in the LHC at CERN, if not harder, because the complexity of dealing with humans as social beings is easily as complex as working out the inner molecular workings of the brain, but because our social behavior is a projection of that complexity and influenced by the complexity of the other individuals we interact with, it's an even harder problem than figuring out how the brain itself works.
I have a question from a listener who didn't want to go on the air. He asked where the article on the cerebellum can be found. And John, I think you were the one who made reference to that.
Yeah, if you go to NPR's website in npr.org and you search for my name, John Hamilton, John is spelled J-O-N, and type in cerebellum, I believe that's the first hit you will get. It's two parts about how the cerebellum works, and I don't think it's hard to find if you use our search function.
Lee, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, sir.
Certainly.
I enjoy it.
Thank you. What's on your mind?
Well, I just wanted to applaud the university. I am an adjunct. That means I'm an industrial, retired, semi-retired guy who teaches in the School of Technology. But I've been assigned through the Luger Center to a spin-up company that is a research development out of the Electrical Engineering School for a solar inverter. And the Research and Technology Corporation spun us up after recognizing the prolific research work of this professor, DeSantos, Dr. DeSantos, and made us a company. So we have been spun up, and I think it's just a marvelous program to give us the opportunity to take the technology developed right here. And we're involved in solar and with all the other storage technologies and so on, without getting too complicated. Mm-hmm. The Research and Technology Corporation is just a marvelous organization. I want to say thank you, and I'll step back.
Thanks very much for the call, Lee. Certainly. Simon, obviously you like hearing that.
I certainly like hearing that, in terms of the outcomes of research, the real impact of research, that's a good example. Lee was referring to research that comes out of our Richard G. Lugar Center for Renewable Energy, which is crosses a number of schools but has many faculty in the School of Engineering and Technology. One of the issues with renewable energy is how to integrate that renewable energy into the standard electricity grid, and that's the role of these inverters that Lee was talking about. So folks can put solar panels in their house and integrate them into the rest of the electrical grid in their community. So this kind of research with practical applications is obviously a very important outcome of what we do, but it doesn't mean that we neglect the perhaps more esoteric kinds of research that maybe right now don't seem to have any practical applications, but down the road, just like the optogenetic tools that John was talking about, will have real impact on fields in medicine and technology.
John, real quickly, because we're getting close to the end of the program, what is the hardest thing about understanding science for general audiences to grasp?
I think the hardest thing is for them to think like a scientist. Scientists, so years of training of a type of critical thinking that I get the impression a lot of people don't get much of when they're in school. So trying to approach a problem the way a scientist does, I think, is often the hardest thing for the public to sort of grasp.
And by thinking like a scientist, what do you mean by that?
You mean coming up with a testable hypothesis, ruling out confounding factors, always questioning the apparent answer, challenging it, trying to show that it's false, and proceeding in this very deliberate fashion. I think that's a process that is not well understood outside of the sciences.
And Simon, we've gotten a question by email from a listener. I hope I'm pronouncing the name right. Name Sel or Don, actually. There's a more complicated long name here. That sets you up for a kick out here. Okay. Is there a website for the Science Day agenda on April 8th?
Absolutely. So go to research.ipy.edu/events/researchday.
Okay. And is there a cost if people want to attend?
No cost at all.
No cost. So they can, and if they go there, they can just walk into any event. Are there going to be people presumably to guide them around?
Yes, absolutely. There'll be staff from my office who will be there to show people to where they want to go.
Well, I would like to thank both of you. This has been a fascinating conversation. I've enjoyed talking with both of you. I'd like to thank my guests, Simon Atkinson and John Hamilton. I hope you both have a very successful research day on Friday. I also would like to thank our listeners for some great questions and invite everybody to come back on Thursday when we're going to be talking about the Krista Morehouse Authors and Books Luncheon. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Terzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.